Hi, and welcome to the Sense Making in a Changing World podcast. I'm Morag Gamble. In this episode, I'm so delighted to be speaking with Eric Ressler, founder and creative director of Cosmic by Design, a social impact creative agency based in the States. And his team helps authentic, purpose-driven companies and not-for-profit organizations to spark, empower, and catalyze positive change, find their impact stories, amplify their voice, and really to be seen in the noisy social media space to be able to inspire positive action. Eric partners with organizations that are doing amazing work for people and the planet, from the climate justice movement, food systems projects, arts equality projects, digital philanthropy, ocean care, regional mountain trail programs, green power projects, social entrepreneurs, community education, even the Lakota People's Law Project, community land trust, and a whole lot more. So for those of you who know me and the programs we host around the world, you can imagine how super keen I am to chat with Eric. This podcast is an initiative of the Permaculture Education Institute and our Permaculture Educators Program. Sharing permaculture is our way of speaking up for the planet, for life, and for exploring the many ways that permaculture thinking, education, and action can support the transition to a regenerative, rewilded, resilient, and beautiful future. Through our Permaculture Educators Program, we're teaching permaculture teachers on six continents who localize and enrich it, find appropriate ways to apply the planet care ethics of earth care, people care, and fair share wherever they are. I know the insights that Eric shares here in this episode are going to be so valuable to any listener who's wanting to share their project, their passion, or offering out into the world with clarity and positive impact. I'm recording this episode from my hand-built solar-powered studio here on beautiful Gubbi Gubbi country, surrounded by my permaculture design gardens. I acknowledge that this is and always will be Aboriginal land, pay my respects to the elders, past and present, and extend my respect to Indigenous cultures and knowledge systems across the planet. Before we jump in, I'd like to invite you to subscribe to Sense Making in a Changing World on your favourite podcast app, and make sure also to leave us a five-star review and a lovely little comment, because it really does help the bots find our show. Okay, let's go. I hope you find a lot of value in this conversation, and I really thank Eric for his generosity of ideas. Oh, and remember, check out the show notes below for all the links. Welcome to the show today, Eric. It's an absolute delight to have you here. One of the key things that I really wanted to focus in with you about is the work that you do with social impact, obviously. So perhaps that's a really good place to begin, is how do you define social impact, and what are the kind of organizations that you've been working with to help to do that work?
We think about social impact organizations as organizations that exist at their core as their main purpose to move humanity forward in one way or another. And we don't really care so much how you file your taxes if you're doing that authentically. So a lot of our clients are nonprofits, yes. Some of our clients are corporations or B Corps or social enterprises. But we also work with funders, government entities, philanthropists, impact investors, people who are funding kind of organizations who are doing kind of more boots on the ground work. The most important thing for us and the way that we assess whether or not a client is going to be a good fit for our mission at Cosmic is, do they exist at their core to move humanity forward? Not as like a CSR campaign or a cause marketing campaign, but is that the reason that they were formed, or at the very least, the reason they exist today?
Mm. Why do you do this work? What inspired you to get involved?
I fell into it is the short answer. So I'm a designer. That's my background. I've been a designer for a long time now. And I went to design school and pretty promptly dropped out and started doing freelance design work, branding work, web design work, some digital media, film, video, just kind of jack of all trades for a little bit. Similar to how I fell into social impact, I kind of fell into running an agency. I didn't have a business plan or, you know, venture capital or working capital to get started. I was doing freelance work. I got really busy and I started asking for help from other designers, and eventually other developers and strategists as well. And organically kind of grew the firm to be about 9 people is where we are today. We've been a little bit bigger. We've been a little bit smaller, but this has been our size for about 7 years now. After about the first 7 years being kind of essentially a generalist agency doing design work and development work and digital work for, you know, a lot of different types of organizations, lot of startups, B2B brands and B2C brands in Silicon Valley. We decided it was time to put a stake in the ground around a particular niche. And we looked back at a lot of the work that we'd done and the work that we felt most inspired by, that we felt like we had contributed most meaningfully to, and found a bunch of different ways to describe the sector that we refer to as the social impact sector. You know, community-based, people-based ways of describing it that don't actually make a sector, but kind of start to hint at some of the elements that are important to us and what we care about. And basically, at that point, we made a decision to focus all of our energy on that sector and those types of organizations, which is still actually a fairly broad sector. And we can get into that more. So we fell into it in that way, too. You know, it was intentional, but we didn't start the agency with that vision in mind. It happened organically.
Mm. Well, you're talking about a space that's very dear to my heart. It's the space that I work in and have my entire life. There was just something in me as I was growing up that drew me into working in this space. I mean, essentially, well-being of people and planet. And I've been drawn into permaculture because at its core, it has these ethics: earth care, people care, and fair share. And so this kind of the fair share ethic is the side of what I wanted to talk with you today about in particular, because I know that you support organizations to be able to share their message in a way that they can either amplify the fundraising they get for that, they can tell their story more widely, they can get more eyes on the really good work that they're doing, which I know is something that so many people that I work with across the planet have struggled with over the years. They just can't be seen quite as much as, you know, the other more slick messages that are out there, or ones that get media attention. So let's just kind of wind back to some of the nuts and bolts of things that are really helpful for organizations, community or business, or however they show up in the world. Like you said, where do you begin to start to tell the story to get eyes more on the work that you do?
So we actually wrote a manifesto about this that sharpens our point of view on how we think about doing this work. And I think it might be good to talk at least in brief about some of the points in that manifesto, even just to kind of provide some strategic framing for before we just dive into tactics and distribution. Okay. and social media and like some of those channels, right? So the manifesto is really supported by this concept called the attention economy. And I think the attention economy is something that most of us have kind of heard, maybe some of us like, you know the official definition of, but it's something that we have all experienced at this point. And the way that I think about the attention economy is that because of the internet and smartphones and this kind of free, open, democratized flow of information that really drives our culture today, we are all very sparse on attention. So whereas before, information used to be kind of privileged and hidden and something that, you know, only certain people and classes were privy to, there's still some of that, but so much information is more accessible, more free, and more available instantly than ever before in any point in humanity for more people than ever before. And that's amazing. And it's beautiful. And there's all these awesome things that come from that, including us being able to do this podcast from across the globe in real time, for example. But there's also some downsides to it that I think we've all started to experience. One of the downsides is that our attention span is shorter than ever before. The ability to capture and sustain attention is becoming increasingly difficult. And I think we all feel it in this kind of sense of information overload and overwhelm and inability to focus and do deep work and some of these things. So that leads to an issue as a social impact leader. If you're trying to raise awareness for your cause, if you're trying to galvanize support, if you're trying to inspire action, get people to take action, get people to volunteer, to donate, to write to, you know, political representatives, to create change, digital organizing is a powerful tool, but everyone's using it. And so I think what that means is that we find ourselves in this culture that ironically is more accessible than ever before, and at the same time, more difficult than ever before to reach people. And I think that our thinking around how to best play in that space kind of branches out from this core concept and needing to understand this is the space that we're playing in, this is the culture that we're playing in, and getting really clear about that and from there, we start to think about, okay, if those are the rules, how can we use them? How can we break them? And how can we be more effective as social impact organizations trying to move our causes forward?
Mm. So in the manifesto, what are some of the key points that you put forward? Could you want to just maybe run us through a couple of those? Because that's the most important place to start, isn't it? To have that big picture. I mean, often we end up playing in the details, and perhaps that's the problem. We sort of scatter our approaches, thinking, oh, a bit of this and a bit of that. Whereas having that cohesiveness is really what you're talking about as well in the social impact campaign, rather than just racing to try and grab what we can as we go.
Definitely. One of the first points in the way we open it is this attention economy concept, because I think it's so fundamental to the rest of the points. The next one that I think is really important is this idea of finding a niche in the social impact ecosystem. In the business world, this might be like positioning and differentiation, but it's essentially like, as an organization, you're focused on a cause that sits within some kind of focus area or category, right? So if you take like sustainable agriculture, for example, right, that is a cause. It's a movement too, right? But it fits in this kind of like category of sustainability, more broadly speaking, right? And there's so many organizations, and this is a great thing, but there's so many organizations in the sustainability space in different ways. There's even so many organizations in the, you know, regenerative and sustainable agriculture space. So what about your organization differentiates you from other people in that space? What are your unique strengths as an organization? What is a fit for you in terms of your focus and what is not? And getting really clear about that, so that as a donor or a supporter or a partner, I understand why I should give you my attention instead of or in addition to someone else in the space too. And when you think, the reason we like this niche ecosystem metaphor, which I think is one that you could probably relate to really directly, is that an effective ecosystem requires specialization. It requires all of these different symbiotic organisms coexisting in a way that creates a stronger overall ecosystem than, like, you know, to use like an agricultural metaphor, like a monocrop, right? Which destroys the environment and, you know, wrecks the soil and produces food that's not as nutritious. So I think it's not really competition in the social impact space so much as it is a need for different organizations to bring their strengths forward and work collaboratively for the greater good of the issue that they're working on. And I think what we see is that a lot of organizations haven't done the work to really nail down their niche. They're clear about their cause, maybe even their vision for a better future, but they can't answer usually how they're meaningfully different than other organizations doing similar complementary work. And I think that's a huge problem. And getting really clear on that, as well as, you know, things like your theory of change or your strategic plan, which all support one another, is really critical to building a clear vision and purpose for your organization. That if you don't have it clearly defined, then it's really hard to do the rest of the work effectively. So that's a really important point. Mm-hmm. And then kind of related to that is this idea of brand building, which is something that's pretty common, again, in the corporate world and in the B2B and B2C world, but something that is like a little off-putting even until recently in the social impact space. Like brand building, isn't that something that, you know, corporations do to make profit? But I think if you really look at brand as being, the way I think about it is kind of like brand with a capital B. And what I mean by that is not your logo and your colors. I mean, those things are important, right? The visual look and feel, the messaging, the story, the impact story, all that's part of brand. All of that's really important too. As a designer, I care deeply about that. But even more so, like your credibility, your reputation, what you say and what you do, and are those things in alignment or are they in contradiction of one another? Because really what it comes down to is, if you're building a brand, you're creating a reputation and an emotional connection with the world and people. And if you nurture that and tend to it and invest in it, it's an impact multiplier. And if you neglect it, it's actually holding you back, even if that might be happening in a way that's invisible or unclear to you. So we believe strongly in brand building. And, you know, there's ways to do brand building right and authentically. And then there's ways to do brand building in a way that is not as effective and even can go all the way to being inauthentic or like cause marketing, where you're basically just investing dollars into advertising and spreading a message that's not authentic to what you're actually doing in the world, right? So brand building is not inherently good, but doing good brand building is inherently effective. And so I think that's a really critical point that, again, you can't really do good brand building if you don't have a clear sense of your niche in the broader ecosystem, because you don't know what promises you're going to make and how you're actually going to make good on those promises.
Mm. Gosh, so many things in there. I felt myself nodding as you were talking, because this authenticity, this deep authenticity of a brand, of a social impact organization goes far. It goes right to the core of what people do. So I'm wondering, like, I see how that relates to what I do. You know, I'm here sitting in the midst of a permaculture eco-village in a solar-powered water collecting home that I built, collecting some resources from around there. You know, the computer that I'm sitting on is powered by the sun, you know. So that authenticity runs deep in what I do. You know, like, everything I do is infused that way, but that's just who I am, and my work has evolved out of my life. But if you're sitting there helping to get an organization to focus on that, how do you as a designer, I guess is my question, how do you as a designer work with that, rather than it being something that is this emergent growth that comes out of an organization or a business?
Yeah. So I think what we find is that almost all folks in this space, there's an origin story to their organization that is a deeply authentic spark, right? There's a reason why you get into running or contributing into a social impact organization. And the spark is not because it's profitable, typically. And it's not to say that it can't be profitable. There's some extremely profitable social impact organizations out there, well-run, strong revenue streams, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it's not usually the reason people get into it. And the case is, and that is not true for a lot of other corporations and business entities, where the motivation and the driving force is money, is profit or power or some kind of combination of those two things, or influence. And so I think what we do and what we see our job as doing is helping organizations who have this authentic origin story, this authentic mission, do a better job of understanding how to articulate that impact story and how to then use that as a strategic force to make their work more effective in the real world. And so it's part culture and clarity of their internal team. And I think that's something that people don't consider branding typically, even though it's actually possibly even the most important and helpful result of doing branding well, is more what happens to your organization internally versus the way that it's perceived in the world. So that's an important element of it. But it's like, how can we help these organizations more clearly articulate who they are and be more effective in how they do their work because of that, versus help them figure out who they are? Now, there are other organizations out there and consultants who will help you do more of that internal work. That's just not our focus as an agency. We do touch it, because when we ask big questions, sometimes we realize that there are big answers that their team needs to think through to be able to enable us to do our work properly. And we will push back on vague answers or organizations saying that they have something figured out. And then we ask some follow-up questions and it becomes clear, like, you've got some rough ideas, but we need to get much more clear about this before we're going to be able to help you really dial in your impact story or run a campaign or whatever the kind of more tactical elements are that we might do down the line. So I think it's for us tapping into that authentic vision and purpose. And oftentimes that's tied back to the origin story in one way or another, even if the organization is 100 years old or 5 years old. There's some kind of, there needs to be, or there often is some kind of through line there. And so I think about us kind of more as like detectives, in the sense that we need to, like, or like archaeologists, even, like, we're kind of digging through the dirt trying to find the gems and then figure out how to better present that organization in a modern way so that they can be more effective in today's culture.
How do you know what's a gem and what's not a gem?
That's a really good question. So some of it, I think, comes down to understanding the audience and who they're trying to serve. Because what often happens in the social impact space, but I think in any space, is that if you're doing this work daily, you're so in it that it's hard to know how what you're saying is perceived by someone who's not doing the work day to day. Even someone who's deeply knowledgeable about the space, but doesn't work in your specific organization. You know, the metaphor of like, it's hard to read the bottle when you're inside the bottle or see the forest from the trees comes to mind. And so part of it is us, the nature of us just being an outside force that can kind of see things fresh. And when clients come to us and say something and we're like, that's not very clear. What do you actually mean by that? Why does that matter? And like digging a couple layers deeper, that's usually where we find the gems. The way they're presenting themselves oftentimes is not really the best way to present themselves or the best way to frame the story. So some of it comes from us just being an outside firm and looking at things fresh and having a different perspective. And I think some of it comes from really deeply understanding their audience and who they're trying to reach. And usually there's a number of different audiences that they need to reach. And what are their motivations? Like, what do they care about? What resonates with them? And then kind of connecting the dots between those two things.
Mm. What I wanted to ask you was around how you are framing this sustainability conversation as well, because there's been such a change in the last few years about the languaging around it, about the imagery that's used with it, about the general feel of where things are going as well. So how have you seen that as a designer, as a communicator? Have you seen that changing? And how, another part of that question is, how do you actually work out who the audience is in sustainability? Because it's kind of like, well, everyone's part of this conversation. It's all generations and across the planet.
I think when the scope and the scale of an issue is this big, it becomes really difficult to grok. I think it's also conflated by the fact that everyone is greenwashing. And so how do you know what is true? And I think this is conflated even further by the information era and so much misinformation and so much that is influenced by our individual media spheres. So it's messy and it's tangled. I think one of the things that we believe in strongly is that when it comes to climate action and sustainability, there's been, rightfully so, a lot of negative and kind of like urgent framing of messaging, and for good reason. But I think the problem is, who's the audience for that message? Because if we're trying to talk about reducing global carbon emissions and we're trying to reach everyday citizens, there are so many massive forces between an everyday person and degrees Celsius per year targets that the metaphor that comes to mind to me is, you feel like an ant trying to make progress pushing a glacier. And I think on top of that, we're framing it in a negative way. We're losing, we're running out of time. Nothing's happening. And a lot of those things are true. But if your goal as a social impact organization is to try to actually drive action, that approach is going to only lead to apathy, and it's not going to be effective. And I think we're all getting burnt out on negative climate messaging because it's so damn depressing. Now, what's the right balance of expressing the truth from a scientific standpoint versus mobilizing people and coming in with messaging that's hopeful? It depends, right? It depends on who your audience is, right? Like, should academic organizations present aspirational messaging to a bunch of scientists? Probably not. But if we're trying to create a movement of people and get them to take action, whatever that action is, and they're everyday citizens who only have so much influence over this in their individual actions, if we lead with negative messaging, it's not going to help. So that's a trend I think that we're starting to see and hopefully being part of. We've run some climate messaging campaigns and run them with much more of an aspirational undertone, and it's led to much more action, I think, because it gives people hope instead of making them just feel doom and gloom.
The radical hope idea. And I love that you mentioned the word aspirational, because often the word aspirational is you know, connected with, or, you know, aspiring to be, you know, wealthy or that, but the aspiration to do good, or the, you know, so can you maybe talk a little bit more around that aspiration, or what makes an aspirational campaign, and how might you kind of share that more with people or inspire people to take on that?
I think it's around where you focus, right? So are you focusing on the problem, or are you focusing on solutions that exist today and actions that you can take today to start to chip away at the problem? And there's a balance there. Like, I think we've all seen the cause marketing campaigns that are fear-mongering and urgent. I mean, especially if you've done anything political in the last 8 years, that's all political fundraising has led to. We need this many donations by today and this zip code, or the world's going to catch on fire. And there's a reason why people do that. It's because it works, but it only works in the short term. And now, even though I'm extremely politically active and motivated and interested, I unsubscribe from every single political campaign, even ones I believe in, because it's just so noisy and they don't follow a really good rule that we set out, which is three gives for every ask. Basically, anytime you're going to ask someone for money, support, signing a petition, whatever it is, you need to have provided roughly three pieces of valuable information or hope or education, so that it's an equal exchange and not an extractive effort. So, you know, I think if we start to look at how can we create and craft a campaign that's aspirational instead of negative, I think it's about celebrating wins, showing impact, telling stories of success, educating in effective ways, surfacing opportunities for me as a supporter to actually get involved and take a meaningful action, whether that's sharing a story, yes, donating in certain cases, yes, volunteering, yes, writing to politicians. What are the actions? You know, it's going to depend on the organization, but focusing on the small steps that we can take in a meaningful way and the positive progress, instead of the like doom and gloom, urgent catastrophe framing that we see so much.
Mm. And I love that, the idea of that, the giving. So, you know, the campaign is actually a gift. It's not like I'm trying to tell you something. I'm not trying to shape, you know, like, it's about how we engage. And there's something in there that you said that I wanted to ask you about. It's a very technical kind of question. You said that that the way that people can actually share back. So how can people share their story? So if you're putting out a campaign and you want people to engage, how do they share their content back rather than just like a chat? What kind of structure? Like, it's a very technical question. Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I mean, I think there's a number of ways that can be done. Some of the political campaigns in the last presidential election cycle in America did a pretty good job of this. So there's platforms out there that allow you to share. It doesn't need to be a highly technical thing, though. It could be, yes, please reply to this email with your story, or fill out this form on your website with this story, or this Google form, right? Like, I think there's so much technology we can use today to reduce the friction of digital communication and sharing. It doesn't need to be a super sophisticated thing. I think it's more in the strategy and the ask and crafting that in a way that's helpful. One thing I would point out is that we've done this work before. Like, one of the big challenges in this work is, you know, everyone wants to show proof of impact and impact stories, but oftentimes, especially if they're impacting a population that's already underserved, is a negative way of kind of framing this, but people who maybe don't have time and money to give, you know, it is something that's worthwhile to invest in, you know, pay people for their time, even if they are a volunteer, you know, so that it's an equal exchange again, if you can afford to budget for that. It doesn't need to be a lot, but just even as a gesture, or a small token of appreciation, it can go a long way as well. I think the other thing, just to kind of dig into deeper here, if someone is following your campaign or your brand, you really need to tap into your expertise as an organization and as an educator on the issues. Because if, as a supporter, I'm following you, I might believe in your cause, but I'm not going to be an expert on and have my thumb on the pulse the same way that you are, living and breathing this work every day. So you have an opportunity as an organization to kind of serve as that authority figure in the space, and not just give me things I can do, but educate me on progress that's being made, on opportunities, on nuance, that I might not have if I'm just reading about this issue in big publications, right? So there's this great opportunity for you to kind of just like break down like what's happening in this issue area and become kind of an expert, a beacon of expertise for everything. So that if I'm following you, I'm informed just by following you on the issues.
Yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. And I think that that thought leadership, because you often forget when you're so into something, not everyone else is so into it as well. You get drawn into your world. And I think that's a really great piece of advice. One of the things I did want to go back to that you were talking about a moment ago was this proof of impact. How do you communicate that? Like, what for you is proof of impact? When you say that, what's the image in your mind?
I think it depends again on who I am, right? So if I'm an everyday citizen that just cares about that issue, I think the most compelling form of impact is impact storytelling. So telling stories around how your organization has actually made progress towards its mission, whether that's an individual story or about a particular person that's been helped, or about a win, like if a bill has been passed because of the work that you've done, or even like progress in the sector that maybe you weren't solely responsible for as an organization, but collectively, the space has been able to make some progress. People want to see progress. It's the return on their investment of time or energy or money against any given issue, is that progress is being made. People want to support organizations that are making an impact, not organizations that have a good mission but aren't making an impact against it. So I think as an everyday person, those are the things I might care about. Now, if I'm an impact investor or a foundation that's providing grants, then I might want to see and maybe even require some actual metrics around that. And, measuring impact is difficult, especially if we're working on issues that are intractable and systems wide. But that doesn't mean it's not worth doing. So I think it really depends on like proof of impact, the requirements for it, or the way that people want it is going to differ very greatly depending essentially on how institutional they are in the spectrum. So an everyday citizen is going to care more about emotional stories and rooted in truth, right? Not storytelling for the sake of storytelling, but they're going to be less arduous in their impact requirements than an institution that's investing literally, or maybe a peer organization that wants to know, okay, this is a great story, but like, how does that actually pencil out in terms of making meaningful progress? So I think it really just depends on where you sit in that spectrum.
Mm. And so in terms of this idea of fundraising and how to fundraise better for these organizations, I wonder if there's something you can offer in that space as well, because, you can get the message out, but it's the ask. I mean, I know you mentioned, three gives for every ask, but let's just talk about the ask a little bit.
So I think a lot of organizations focus too much on the nuance of the fundraising campaign and skip some of these foundational steps that we've been talking about. If you understand the attention economy, if you've been investing in brand building, if you have a clear niche in the ecosystem, a clearly defined and articulated impact story, if you are educating and providing value to your organization, your fundraising is basically done. I don't want to oversimplify it, but if you do all of that well, your ability to fundraise is going to be significantly easier than if you've done none of that well. So it is similar to planting a garden, right? If you do the hard work and till the soil and make sure the environment is right, your plants are going to grow and be healthy. If you just toss seeds everywhere and hope for the best, some might work and some might not. So I really do believe strongly that, and the reason why I believe so much in the work that we do to help our organizations that we partner with is because it pays off in dividends down the line. Now, it's not to say that you can't also and shouldn't also invest, strategically in how you craft your ask and your revenue models and all of that. But I think this kind of foundational work is critical for setting the stage and the success of any kind of, case for support. So that's where I would start. Now, the right strategy is going to differ from organization to organization. We work with clients that are funded, 90% from grassroots small donors. We work with other clients who get, $1,000 a year from those folks and get almost all their money from government gifts government grants or like major gifts or foundation grants. That depends a lot on the sector and their niche and their approach and kind of all of that stuff. Where you sit in that spectrum is going to have a huge implication for how to improve your fundraising. I think especially if you find yourself, I think this foundational work is equally important in different ways for each side of that spectrum, though. And even organizations that say, oh, well, we get, you know, multi-year grants from foundations and we have one-on-one relationships with them, so our branding and our marketing doesn't matter. We haven't seen that to be true. It still matters, I think, a lot in those cases, because even institutional funders want to support organizations that have momentum, similar to how venture capitalists want to support startups that have momentum and engagement. And so all of this, I think, is really important. I think it becomes exceptionally important if you're going direct to consumer, so to speak, and you're trying to raise money through movement building and through, you know, thousands of small donations over time.
I followed what you were saying in terms of broad strategy. It's the long term. It's not just a short term scatter approach. When you're actually coming down to the day to day mapping out of that, is this where you get to into this fine tuning of a campaign as well as this big picture? And are there any tips that you can offer to the organizations that I know that will be listening to this going, okay, so yes. How do I sharpen the tools that I have to do this better, to get more eyes onto what we're doing and to, yeah, cut through the noise that you were mentioning before? Are there any kind of key tips that you can offer in terms of that?
Yeah, I think if you start to think about this from that framework of the attention economy and cutting through the noise, it can help guide some of your thinking there. So how do we capture and sustain attention? And I think that's where it gets creative, right? And I think it's where it can get emotional, because if you're just pumping out content like everybody else and the content itself isn't meaningfully interesting or different, then it's going to be really hard to even start with the capturing of attention and the breaking through, let alone sustaining attention. So I think the way that I would look at this if I were in-house at one of these organizations is do a little bit of an audit on what are our unique strengths as an organization. Like, first of all, do I have my foundation in place? Like, have we figured out, you know, what our niche is? Can we articulate that clearly? You know, is it crafted in a way that's compelling and interesting and emotional and not just matter of fact? I would start there, because if you don't have that in place, it's going to be really hard to run a campaign effectively. And then from there, like, what assets and capacity do we have to build something interesting, creative, different, and compelling? Do we need to bring in an external consultant or contractors, or do we need to partner with an artist? Or let's get creative around how we do this. Let's look for inspiration. Let's look outside of our niche for inspiration. You know, how might I do this if I were a new media company instead of a nonprofit? And start to just think about it from that perspective. What can we do with the capacity that we have? Like, how can we partner with some of our supporters? How can we elevate voices within our own organization or our own community in a way that's interesting? I know these are kind of broad answers instead of tactical answers, and that's kind of intentional, because there is no one right way to do this. You have to find your own way, and you have to approach it from a mindset of curiosity and experimentation. And if you look at it, understanding the attention economy and figuring out how to do something that's interesting and different, you will find a path that works for you. I think the other thing that I would stress is that you do have to be willing to try and fail. I think one of the biggest things we see is that people are afraid of failure here. So they actually ironically sunset their best ideas before they have a chance to see the light of day. And I think if you can fail gracefully and transparently, there is no failure. It's just an experiment. And experiments that fail are valuable in the same way that experiments that succeed are. And so I think that mindset, that kind of beginner's mind, is really important. We've written before about the need to be bold and to try things. We've written before about the need. We wrote an article called In Defense of Moonshots in Philanthropy. I think the philanthropy space and the social impact space is one that's traditionally pretty safe. And there's a lot of reasons why. People want to invest in ideas that are proven because they know they're going to work. But we can't just invest only in ideas that are going to make incremental progress. Those ideas are important. Those causes are important. Incremental progress is good, but it needs to be paired with moonshot ideas that have the potential for, you know, 10 times the impact too. And if you start to think about that, even at the campaign level, okay, we know these things work. Let's invest most of our budget there, but let's take 20% of our budget and do something wild that will likely fail. But if it doesn't, we'll 10x the impact. So thinking about things from that perspective, I think could be a helpful thought exercise if you're in an organization like this.
Thank you. Again, some fantastic insights there. One of the early ones in that conversation there was just around this idea of seeing yourself as a new media organization as opposed to an NGO. I think that's a fantastic insight to really think about yourself in that way as an organization. And the question that I wanted to ask you was about how do you craft a moonshot? For me and lots of the organizations I work with, you know, like this, we have so many goals, but to bring it into this one statement that can encapsulate everything. So I host a trust-based philanthropy organization called Ethos, and we tell the stories of young people who are living in refugee settlements across East Africa to then be able to ask people around the world to support them to create their permaculture gardens and permaculture livelihoods and to bring change in their world. We often find that our message is so broad because their needs are so broad and never quite get to this is what we do. I always find myself like what I just did to you. We do this and this and this and this and this. And it's like, what was that you said it again? just doesn't have the clarity. So just using like this example as a way to sort of shape what I know many, like I said, many other people listening to this are going, okay, yeah, I get what you're saying, Morag. I do that too.
Yeah. In general, some of the kind of key fundamentals of moonshot thinking might be a good way to start there. So, you know, one of those would be dreaming big, right? Like looking for like where you start aiming, like aim further than you think that you'll ever achieve in your wildest dreams, right? Because you're kind of using that as an anchor. And then even if you don't hit that goal, you're more likely to hit a more ambitious goal than you would have if you hadn't started thinking that way. And I think you can apply that in your program design as well as in your marketing and the way that you frame your impact story. So I guess dream big is step one. And then I think related to that would be ignore constraints at first. Don't start with constraints. Put the constraints aside. What would you do if you had all the money in the world? If you had all the capacity in the world, like what would it look like in that case? And how would you act? And how would you think? Again, you know, this isn't magic. You're not going to go from where you are to there. I think it's common in the social impact space because of how money flows or doesn't to be constrained, to have constraints. And constraints can bring creativity too, don't get me wrong. And we work with constraints all the time in our work. But if you start with the constraints, it can hold back the potential impact you can have. So starting to think from that perspective and really very quickly moving from that into testing those big ideas with as little cost as possible and getting them in front of people that matter as soon as possible. So some of this starts to overlap with some design thinking principles, right? Getting in front of the people that you're trying to reach, whether that's people that you're supporting or people that you need support from, with ideas in a prototype pencil sketch phase even, and getting input quickly so that you're making sure that you're designing solutions that will actually pencil out in the real world instead of things that sound good, but then you invest all this time and effort and money and then they don't actually end up penciling out in the way that you anticipated that they might. So I would say, you know, start with this kind of beginner's mind moonshot thinking, put the constraints aside, dream big, prototype that, get it in front of people, whether that's a funder or a partner or someone that you're trying to help, and get some real-time feedback and start to like listen and get into a mindset of being curious. And I think from there, then you can slowly start to get into, okay, so how do we right size this for our constraints and our resources right now? Or how do we pitch a really compelling ask and paint a really clear vision? And, you know, then maybe we start to see some success fundraising for that, because funders and supporters are going to be attracted to things that are inspiring much more than things that are kind of run of the mill.
And I wonder what kind of platforms that you find are the most effective in terms of sharing this out. Is there any one particular one, or is, again, this is like, well, it all depends is the answer?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've seen is that you need to find the platform that works for your audience, and it's not going to be the same for everyone. So the way that I think about this is that if you're doing this work, building a brand, investing in marketing, you're basically building a large machine, a flywheel, if you will. If you invest in it and build it over time, it will start to have some of its own momentum and start to spin. The middle or the hub of that flywheel is your website, and it always will be. I mean, maybe not in 50 years or something, but there's no trend suggesting otherwise for now. And yes, that's true even with how much social media is become important as a communication channel, and it's still true even for younger audiences, which is something that people think, you know, young people don't use websites, which is just not true. That's where I would start, is like getting that effectively working. And then everything else is really just a branch off of that and should be leading back to it. So if you are doing email, then it should be driving people back to the website, because the website needs to be an operational asset for creating change, not just a digital brochure. It needs to educate people. It needs to inspire people. It needs to, you know, surface opportunities for action. It needs to get people excited about the work. So it has so much responsibility to do that. Even if the way that people are getting to the website, like, no one is going to bookmark, well, some people might bookmark your website, but people do not come to your website typically because they've bookmarked it or because they remember the URL and type it in. They see a piece of content, or they see a link, or they're sent something through some social channel. So there's these inlets in, roads into the website, but all paths should lead back to it. And then you just need to look at, what are the paths that are most effective? What's the content strategy that's most effective for us, that, you know, keeping the attention economy in mind? Can we do things like podcasts instead of articles, or in addition to articles? Can we do short videos? What's the content format that's most compelling? I think one of the reasons podcasts are so popular still and continue to grow in popularity is because they're so authentic. They're so conversational. They're so human. And they can go deep in a world in which everything else is so surface. You know, maybe it is a mix of all of those things across different channels. I would rather see organizations pick a couple key channels and do them really well versus feel like they must be in every, you know, new flavor of social media and do none of them all that well.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I wonder who you watch and who you listen to. Where do you get your inspiration from?
It's broad. It's interesting because I feel like information has become so distributed at this point. You know, I have different news outlets that I follow, but I have a lot of different Substacks that I follow. I have individuals that I follow. I have podcasts that I really like to listen to. So it's pretty broad, you know, and then I also play in these two ecosystems and play in the intersection of those, which is essentially design and social impact. So I have publications and thought leaders and individuals that I follow in each of those spaces, and then figure out, how do we connect the dots between those two things? So, you know, it's pretty broad for me, and I'd be happy to kind of talk about specifics. But yeah, it's interesting because it's changed a lot for me over the transition of the, as the internet has matured and the way that content and information changes. I actually don't use very much social media personally. There's a couple, I use LinkedIn a lot professionally. I follow a lot of really great people on LinkedIn, and I find it to be the least toxic social media platform, oddly, because I used to think it was the most boring one. And now I feel like it's actually like resurged. Maybe it's just me. I don't know.
No, I've actually been finding that I've been drawn to that as well. You know, that's where I find those really authentic voices without all the hype so much, and you know, really well-researched articles are being shared, and I find it really, really helpful too. You've talked about Substack and articles and things. So is the blog in that way still a really powerful place to be, do you think?
Absolutely. I think the thing that's so amazing about Substack is that Substack made the newsletter cool again, even though the newsletter had not really ever fully gone out of style. I think part of that is because they nailed the user experience as a product. But part of it is that they also empowered thought leaders and writers and people who published the ability to do it on their own for a living. It's really powerful in certain ways. There's certainly downsides. You know, there's a lot of power in working for an institution and having editors and all of that too. You know, the resources behind, you know, an organization like the New York Times versus a freelance writer on Substack is, you know, night and day different. And certain topics would be really hard, if not impossible, to cover without some of the financial backing and resources of a, you know, larger organization or like ProPublica or whatever, right? I think Substack showed that at the end of the day, it's really about ideas more than anything else. And format is important. You know, how do you share those ideas? Is it written? Is it long form? Is it short? Is it TikTok? Is it a video? I think what the internet has shown us is that there's a place and a time and power in every type of format. And it really just kind of depends on who your audience is. And different formats lend themselves better to different things. Like podcasts that are long form are great for going deep on something where you want to get into the nuance, or you want to be able to have a conversation about it, or you want to surface the humanity behind it. In a way that you're just never, ever going to do on TikTok. It's just impossible just because of the format. But TikTok has its own, you know, place to be able to like quickly appeal to many people. And because of the way their algorithms work, as you first get started, they give you a little boost and you have the ability to kind of like very quickly start to gather an audience if you're producing good content. So I think email is still, and articles and blogging, if the ideas are good and the content is good, is still extremely viable as a solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. I've got so many more questions, but I think it's probably fair to wrap up here and respect your time. Just wanted to check in with you first about where is it that people can find your manifesto? We can link that down to the show notes, but are there other links that we can share as well to people who are listening right now that we can send them off to?
Sure. So, you know, we take our own advice here and that our website is the place to go. Designbycosmic.com. We have a manifesto tab right at the very top. It's the very first link on our website. We also publish insights, so articles, white papers. We have podcasts like this on the site as well. So there's actually a ton of content on our site to dig into. I would start with the manifesto. It's really good, like introductory framing to our thinking, but there's a lot more content than just that. Of course, we have case studies and things like that on our site as well. And then, yeah, I'm trying to be a little bit more active on LinkedIn these days and just kind of sharing things more conversationally, engaging in conversations there as well. So feel free to follow Cosmic or me personally on LinkedIn too. And of course, you can subscribe to our newsletter, but we basically just kind of in our newsletter share all the things you're going to find on our website on LinkedIn anyway, but it's just a nice way to stay connected. Because again, you're probably not going to bookmark our website and remember to come back every week. So yeah, I'd say the website is the first place to start.
Yeah, great. Look, thank you so much today, Eric, for spending the time exploring this. It's such a huge topic. There's so much good work going on out there in every community. And I know that there's a struggle. So I think there's a conceptual shift that needs to happen. And then these broad strategies, these really authentic approaches that you're talking about, and the shifting about thinking about what is branding and how to approach the fundraising, that it is this long form shaping of how we present ourselves.
Thank you for the opportunity. First of all, I really enjoyed the conversation. Everyone has that spark that got them involved in whatever cause or whatever organization or whatever kind of path they're on. And I think just staying true to that is really the core strategy to everything else. And so, you know, don't lose sight of what got you into it in the first place.
A beautiful place to end. Thank you so much, Eric. It's been lovely chatting with you today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for tuning into this episode of Sense Making in a Changing World with social impact creative Eric Ressler. Check out the show notes below to find out more about Eric's work and the resources he mentioned. Also, the show notes is where you'll find details of our permaculture work, our YouTube, our blog, free masterclasses and film clubs, and also our permaculture design and teaching courses. And did you know that we also now have a new permaculture marketing program here at the Permaculture Education Institute called Share Permaculture? So join us to learn skills for designing, teaching permaculture, and making it a good livelihood while living a permaculture-inspired, one planet way of life. We'll see you next time.